Welcome to the Bardcast. It's Shakespeare, you dick. We are your hosts. I am Lisa Ann Goldsmith.
And I am Owen Thompson.
And today's episode is Song and Dance Shakespeare. There's lots of songs and dances in Shakespeare, actually.
So much. There's so much. So much. And we may not cover it all because there's just, I mean, it's beyond.
That's right.
Our usual disclaimer.
That's true, actually. It's just an enormous topic, which is why we can do this podcast forever.
Exactly. I was going to say that is why we've been able to do this for almost 2 years and with no sign of stopping, because it is remarkable for such a comparatively small body of work. How much stuff is crammed into these plays.
Yeah, it's amazing. So we thought we would start with a little bit of background about song and dance during the Elizabethan times. Now, during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, between 1533 and 1603, you know, guys, we do give you dates over and over again, but that's because we're trying to drill them into your heads the way they're drilled into our heads.
Well, also, who knows what order people are listening to these podcasts?
That's true. But anyway, during the reign of Queen Elizabeth, music and dance received an unprecedented amount of refinement and advancement. Her passion for the musical arts gave birth to several generations of celebrated musicians and dance teachers who created whole new suites of dances that were regularly used by both the nobility and the common people. During her reign, dancing was considered a wholesome recreation of the mind and also an exercise of the body. Elizabeth herself was proficient in many instruments, and she practiced many styles of dances every day. In fact, some reports say that she danced as many as 7 galliards each morning, and a galliard is a very demanding and very energetic style of dance. So, you know, think about that. That's like doing 7 really intense yoga classes every morning. That's a lot.
Pretty impressive. And yeah, honestly, there's a connection here to like later periods in that starting in this period, people in the nobility were expected to know how to dance.
That's right. That's right. Because of her practice, she demanded that the entire court know all the intricacies of musical and dancing arts. And popularity of dance went to such a high degree that time that it has been said that some of the great political and romantic court battles of that time were not fought by political means, but on the dancing floors of the London court.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you see, you know, or if you read the books of Jane Austen, let's say, or see Sense and Sensibility,
right,
or, you know, that kind of thing, people, and you see them dancing at these elaborate dances, you know, even on Bridgerton, God help us all.
God help us all.
Oh, my God. Anyway, but the nobility and even the aristocracy, well, the aristocracy is the nobility, but even people who were socially ambitious, you needed to know how to dance to be at these social occasions where dancing was a major thing. So especially members of the aristocracy, young men were expected to learn how to fence and that sort of thing.
Of course.
And ride, and many young women learned how to ride as well, but everybody had to learn how to dance if you were of a certain social status.
Yeah, and it definitely went a long way towards assuring that you would get matched in a proper match. So,
yeah.
But some of the dances that were used by the upper class and the court were most often imported from other countries. Merchants and nobles who would travel all over Europe would bring back to England dances from Italy and Spain and France, and the influence of those would lead to the creation of new styles of dance. So some of the most notable dances of the Elizabethan era for high-class audiences were the pavane, which required a processional of men and women who would only very, very lightly and slightly touch their fingers together. The galliard, which I mentioned, which is a very quick and energetic dance. The almain, which is performed with a keyboard and lute instrument as a backup. The vault, which is the only Elizabethan dance that allowed an embrace of dancers. The gavotte, which is a very popular sort of a median tempo dance that actually incorporates a kiss as one of its moves. The courante, which is a slow-moving French dance. And ballet, of course, which was imported from Italy and danced by both novices and Let's Try That Again, which was danced by both novices and professionals.
And the jig. Don't forget the jig.
That's right. The jig, which I know you're going to talk about a little later on as far as Will Kemp, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, Elizabethan music would complement the different forms of Elizabethan dance. And the emergence of these different styles of music and new musical instruments combined with various experiments combining different instruments led to these new dances being created. Now, just a quick thing on music in Shakespeare's plays, right?
Before we move on to music, I just want to ask you something, since we're both veterans of the New York Renaissance Fair.
Oh, Lord.
Did you have to do any of these dances at the fair?
I did. I don't remember because it was like another lifetime ago.
And of course,
yes.
we've also been required to do them in Shakespeare performance. I remember being very glad that I had actually studied the Pavane when I got hired at the New York Renaissance Fair.
Because no
almost
kidding.
Almost the first fucking thing that happened to me was I was put in this stupid scene where I had to do this endless fucking Pavane. And it's just you process around with the fingers and the touching and the
and
this
you turn
and the that.
And you bow and you scrape and yeah.
And no, I'd actually taken a class in period dance before. Wow. I was in a school in London. And so I was a little bit prepared, even though it was rusty, but you know. The
and
Pavane. Oy.
Remember that I played Mireille, the court singer. So I had to play on the guitar and sing a bunch of these songs that they would dance to.
Right. Well, also, lest we forget, it was. I remember that when you and I were working on Romeo and Juliet and you were choreographing it for me, you choreographed a Pavane-like number for, you know, in the ball scene.
I sure did. I sure did.
There's that Pavane again.
Yeah, well, it lent itself very well to the stuff that Romeo and Juliet say to each other.
Of course, of course. So. Yes. It's a freaking ball.
Yeah, it's a fucking ball. So Shakespeare used vocal music to evoke mood. Like, for example, Come Thou Monarch, you know, to provide ironic commentary on plot or character, like O Mistress, sung by one of the actors in the company, Robert Armin, in the role of Feste, is directed towards the aging Sir Toby Belch and Sir Andrew Aguecheek, and the lyrics kind of touch on all the themes of the play. The magical and ritual uses of song are like central to such plays as Midsummer Night's Dream, The Tempest, and Macbeth. But Shakespeare.
Although, I question the whole thing about Macbeth, because the witches, you could say the weird sisters are maybe chanting or singing, but the major quote unquote musical number from that show is the dance and song led by Hecate.
Right.
And that was not written by Shakespeare.
Right. That's fair. That's fair.
That was written by Thomas Middleton, the Hecate scene. So I personally don't count Macbeth as a play that has a bunch of singing and dancing in it.
Note taken. So Shakespeare.
It's just as easy to get these things right.
Shakespeare also used songs to establish a character or the mental state of the character that was doing the singing. Like, for example, Ariel just describes himself as in Where the Bee Sucks, which, by the way, if you listen to our podcast, that's the song that we use in our intro.
That's right.
That's right.
That's from The Tempest.
Iago would use songs to give himself the appearance of a rough soldier, you know, and probably most significantly, Ophelia's snatches of folk song demonstrate the regressive breakdown of her brain. Right. So, yeah, there are hundreds of references to music in the works of Shakespeare.
Hundreds.
They can be placed into three general categories. The first would be incidental music, you know, and because lots of times in Shakespeare plays, you see the stage directions, music here, or music begins, or music for dancing, but they never give you the individual titles of the song. The second category would be literary references. You know, Shakespeare refers to music, music theory, and instruments of the time within the text of his work. For example, a humorous example is found in the names of the musicians whom Peter confronts in Romeo and Juliet. Their names are Hugh Rebeck, Simon Catling, and James Soundpost. Now, a Rebec, sometimes also known as the Rebecca, is a bowed string instrument of the medieval era and the early Renaissance. A Catling is a string for a musical instrument, often the smallest string on a lute. And a Soundpost is a small post, usually made of pine on guitars and violins, that joins the front surface to the back, helping to support the bridge, allowing the whole body of the instrument to vibrate. And then the third category would be songs, right? Specific songs are included for performance in the text of Shakespeare's plays. He authored the lyrics to some of these songs, but he also incorporated popular songs that would be known to his contemporary audiences.
Yeah, and there's some debate over whether or not Shakespeare, which songs are Shakespeare lyrics and which songs are extant songs that he used. I mean, some of them we know are songs that he incorporated, like, for instance, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later on, but when Desdemona sings the Willow Song before she's murdered by Othello, that was a well-known popular song of
That's
the
right.
day.
That's
so
right.
it was used specifically for effect. And we also know that Shakespeare didn't write the lyrics, and certainly not the music to that song, but it's debatable. There are other songs that he may or may not have written the lyrics to. Like a good example of that is a couple of the songs in Twelfth Night, Oh Mistress Mine, for instance, which it sure sounds like Shakespeare, those lyrics. But on the other hand, we actually do have musical settings for that song that we know predate the first performance of that play. So it's possible that Shakespeare used an extant song there. We just don't know.
That's right. But like, for example, we definitely know that Robert Johnson's setting for Full Fathom Five in mm-hmm. The Tempest is the same as when originally performed, because he is well documented as Shakespeare's composer.
Right. Although what's interesting about that, and I just want to, it's possible that Johnson worked with a person named Jack Wilson. And what's particularly interesting about that, Jack with an E on the end, J-A-C-K-E, mm-hmm. Jack Wilson often there would be one or two boy players in the company that were good singers or knew how to play an instrument. They were, musical capabilities of Shakespeare's company were probably pretty limited when they were at either one of their theaters, the Globe or Blackfriars or a place like that, and much expanded when they were at court. But Jack Wilson was a boy who actually finds his way into the stage directions in the first folio. And we know that he sang the song Sigh No More in Much Ado.
That is so cool.
And what's interesting, now this is sort of speculation. So that it's already cool that we know that a boy named Jack Wilson was the singer of that song. And also almost certainly the singer of that song in Measure for Measure. But what's really interesting is that that Johnson, as a composer, worked with another composer much, much later on towards the end of Shakespeare's career, whose name was John Wilson. And since Jack is short for John, some people have speculated that that John Wilson is the Jack Wilson who sang like when he was a boy and then grew up to be a composer and worked with another collaborator of Shakespeare.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
That is really cool. You know, there was an extract from a chapter on music in the Oxford Handbook of the Age of Shakespeare.
You're getting technical.
Well, no, because I was wondering like what kinds of instruments they would use, right? And this chapter explains that while the instruments at Shakespeare's disposal would have been limited, it was possible to identify what a standard musical ensemble would have looked like in the late 16th century. It points to six instruments first referred to explicitly in an account of the entertainment provided for Queen Elizabeth in 1591. The account reads as follows. After this speech, the fairy queen and her maids danced about the garland, singing a song of six parts, with the music of an exquisite consort, wherein was the lute, the bandura, the bass viol, the cittern, the treble viol, and the flute. And the cittern was the precursor to the modern guitar, while Right. And the bandora was a bass counterpart to the cittern, believed to have been invented in London in 1562.
Well, and what's also interesting is that a number of these instruments actually had connotations one way or the other with an Elizabethan Jacobean audience, right? By that I mean like oboes, which were actually they weren't what we would think of as oboes, but a predecessor of those called, that were referred to as either hoboys or hautboys, right?
I like hoboys.
Hoboys. So if you heard the music of a hoboy, those were considered to be ominous sounding instruments, right? So yeah, they would be employed if a scene was getting like, because music, incidental music was almost certainly used to underscore mood and drama and tension.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Just, I mean, very similarly to the way movies are scored these days, right?
Right.
So if an Elizabethan audience heard hoboys playing, like they knew something bad was going to happen, right? And speaking of the lute and the viol, they were perceived as benign forces of music, right? So if you heard, those would be lighter, right? If you heard that kind of sound, you would think that something was good was going to happen. And those are stringed instruments. And it's actually, that leads to one of my favorite quotes about music in all of Shakespeare, which I've often quoted in my personal life. And it's about Jack Wilson singing Sigh No More, Ladies. In that play, the boy sings that song. And afterwards, Benedict says, "Is it not strange that sheep's guts should hail men's souls out of their bodies?"
I love that line.
Because, of course, the strings of the instruments were made from sheep's guts. And so, yeah, I mean, which is just a really, really interesting way of saying, my God, why does music move us so much?
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. So I have a bunch of quotes actually that talk about dances and songs in Shakespeare. But before we get to that, I think there was something you wanted to talk about, wasn't there, Earl?
Well, I just wanted to add a couple of things. First of all, it was very, very customary for like almost every single play in Shakespeare's time to include at least one song.
Right.
And also almost every play, in fact, I think every play concluded with a dance when the play was over, sort of what we would consider a curtain call. And if you go to Shakespeare's Globe, you will see they almost always do this in performance. There will be a dance after the end of the play. No matter, like, you know, and this means the end of Hamlet, when there's a pile of bodies on the stage.
It's often a jig, isn't it?
Everybody will get up and do some kind of Elizabethan Jacobean dance, right?
Yeah.
It was custom. But interestingly, Shakespeare broke with tradition, because the tradition came was mostly that lighter plays, comedies, or even histories would contain a song or two, but not heavy tragedies. And that dates back to the Senecan tradition of tragedy. But in some of his major tragedies, he introduces songs, most particularly in Othello, King Lear, and Hamlet.
Right.
I mean, the fool sings quite a bit in Lear, and also Edgar sings snatches of folk songs when he's pretending to be
crazy.
That's right. But most interestingly and innovatively, and also possibly controversially, because an audience would not have been expecting it, if you think about when Ophelia is going crazy and she sings those heartbreaking folk songs.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And then, of course, as we've mentioned, Desdemona singing the Willow Song in that incredibly tense moment before she's about to be murdered. Those were things that would, I won't go so far as to say I think they would have shocked an audience, but they for sure would have surprised an audience, because A, tragedy didn't feature songs, but B, also the characters that sing songs in Shakespeare's play and in his contemporaries' plays, the characters are usually servants, clowns,
right,
and low-born characters, right? In fact, Ophelia and Desdemona are literally the only two Shakespeare heroines who sing.
Right, that's right.
So it's that much more notable and you know, again, borderline shocking that they would sing the way they do.
So here's a question for you, Owen. Do you think that that one of the reasons why when Ophelia's going crazy, I mean, she is nobility, right? Like she's of the upper class. The songs that she would know would have been songs that were sung around court. So do you think that Shakespeare specifically, so as to not insult or, cause any problems with the nobility, chooses those characters singing like low class songs?
Well, in Ophelia's case, it must have been double shocking because those songs are pretty bawdy that she sings. I mean, they're sexual songs, and so there, I think, it works so well in performance because it's shocking to see her mentally broken that way, and it's shocking for the people in the scene. It's Gertrude and Claudius, and then later her own brother who see her that way, and it's fucking heartbreaking. But it would have had, all I'm saying is it would have had double force or more force in Shakespeare's time because nobody would have, obviously it would be a new play, but also it was breaking with a tradition, and that tradition goes back at least as far as 1561, the musical tradition. That's when Gorboduc, which was the very first English five act drama in
I'm
blank
sorry.
verse.
Gorboduc immediately brings up an image to me of a cartoon version of Gorbachev
Okay, we're dating ourselves, but yes, I see the little stain on the duck's head. Oh my God. Yeah, fair though. But no, Gorboduc was a play by Thomas Sackville and Thomas Norton from 1561, which was the very first English five-act drama in blank verse. And it also used a five-part instrumental ensemble that accompanied the dumb shows, which was like a mimed part of the show that was traditional then. And that kind of set the pattern for it.
Yes, people, dumb because they weren't speaking, not dumb because it was stupid.
Dumb because silent, right? And also in terms of musical performance, there was a tradition of choir boy dramas that were presented at court throughout the entire 16th century. And those, we've talked about the boy companies before, the Children of Paul's and the Gentlemen and Children of the Chapel Royal, two groups that Shakespeare was often at odds with and talks about disparagingly a lot in Hamlet. But they did a lot of choir boy dramas that involved a lot of singing. And they're satirized, actually, when in Midsummer Night's Dream, what dreadful dole is here and all of that stuff. That is actually almost certainly a satire of the boys' companies.
A choir boy drama sounds to me like a skit that Saturday Night Live would do about kids that were sexually abused when they were altar boys.
But yeah, the dancing, just to mention some of the dances as well. We talked about the jigs, right? They were very popular. These were bawdy, half improvised, low comedy burlesque songs that got that, there were a lot, like they would be interpolated into the shows. And Will Kemp, who was a clown that was in the first half of Shakespeare's career, was the major clown of his company, of the Lord Chamberlain's men. He was famous for doing a jig all the time.
That was his
And he
deal.
those would be performed to like popular songs, and then he would like go off and improvise, which it again, it sounds to me like going back to Hamlet, with Shakespeare, Hamlet's advice to the players sounds like he was pretty annoyed at people like Will Kemp.
There's lots of dances that are mentioned in Shakespeare play. In fact, the jig itself is specifically notated in Love's Labour's Lost, Act 3, Scene 1, Much Ado About Nothing, Act 2, Scene 1, Country Footing, which is a jig, is mentioned in The Tempest, Act 4, Scene 1. And some of the other dances that are mentioned are the Volta in Troilus and Cressida and Henry V, the Coranto in All's Well That Ends Well and Twelfth Night, the Galliard, also called the Syncpace or Syncopace in Twelfth Night, Much Ado About Nothing and Henry V. A measure or an old measure is in As You Like It, Richard II, Much Ado About Nothing, and the Canario is mentioned in All's Well That Ends Well. And Mark.
I feel the need to point out, speaking of the syncopace and Twelfth Night, that the way that it's mentioned in Twelfth Night is when Sir Toby finds out that Sir Andrew is a good dancer And he's like, wherefore are these talents hid? And he has a whole thing about like, if I could dance that way, I would do this, I would do that. And at one point he says, I would not so much make water, but in a syncopace,
That's
which is
right.
to say, I would be dancing while I pissed.
And the Marish dance is mentioned in a whole bunch of Shakespeare plays. So, a Marish dance was an English folk dance that was accompanied by music. It was based on rhythmic stepping and the execution of like choreographed figures by a group of dancers, usually wearing like bell pads on their shins. It also used implements such as sticks and swords and handkerchiefs, that kind of thing. But that is mentioned, oh my God, in Henry the Sixth, Part Two, All's Well That Ends Well, Henry the Fifth, and in Two Noble Kinsmen, which, yes, it is a collaboration between William Shakespeare and John Fletcher. There is an entire scene that's built around Morris dancing. So.
And isn't if I'm not incorrect, isn't a Morris dance like based in fertility dances? And wasn't it commonly done around the maypole, like the
Yes.
raising of a phallic symbol and all of that?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Again, see, again, Shakespeare likes dick references, hence the title of this podcast.
Yes. And so we are up to basically songs in his plays that are textual, that are written out in text. So some of the notable examples are, well, in Midsummer Night's Dream, like Owen was talking about, when Bottom becomes an ass, he sings the O so cock so black of hue with orange tawny bill. That's a big one. Tell Me Where Is Fancy Bread in Merchant of Venice, Act 3, Scene 2. When Daisy's Pied and Violet's Blue, which is in Love's Labour's Lost, Act 5, Scene 2.
Who is Sylvia?
Right, Sigh No More, Lady Sigh No More, which you talked about in Much Ado About Nothing. And then As You Like It has Under the Greenwood Tree. It has Blow, Blow, Thou Winter Wind. And it has It Was a Lover and His Last. There's a ton in there.
Yeah, the some so obviously some of these plays are more musical in nature than others. The three big ones are probably As You Like It, Twelfth Night, and The Tempest.
That's right.
And one reason people think that the Twelfth Night particularly has so many songs in it is that that's probably about the time that Robert Armin became the chief clown of the company after Will Kemp left. And people have speculated that Robert Armin had a better singing voice and might have been better at playing instruments than Will Kemp. And so more music was incorporated. But also, and I think this is actually really important to bear in mind, like I was sort of saying before, the amount of instruments and musical resources that Shakespeare had at his command were somewhat limited when they were
Right.
playing in the playhouse, but they were much, much more robust when they played at court because they had access to court musicians
Of
and more
course,
instruments and
yeah.
that sort of thing. So many, it's been pointed out that both Twelfth Night and The Tempest were almost certainly presented first at court before the Twelfth Night, definitely, and The Tempest almost certainly.
Oh, yeah.
So it's likely that the reason that those two plays are more musical in nature than many of the others is simply because Shakespeare had access to more musical resources in the production of those plays.
Well, you play to the strength of what your cast is, right?
Exactly.
So in Twelfth Night, there's "O Mistress Mine, Where Are You Roaming?" And a lot of those are sung by Festy, the clown. In Measure for Measure, we have "Take, Oh, Take Those Lips Away."
Also probably sung by Jack Wilson.
That's right. In Cymbeline, we have "Hark, Hark the Lark," which just makes me laugh. And one of Shakespeare's most famous songs, "Fear No More the Heat of the Sun," is also from Cymbeline.
Beautiful one.
Gorgeous. Which Stephen Sondheim put in his production of The Frogs. Actually,
That's
he took
right.
that right from Shakespeare. We have "When Daffodils Begin to Peer" from The Winter's Tale, Act 4, Scene 3. We have "Full Fathom 5" from The Tempest, Act 1, Scene 2. And as we mentioned, our opening song, "Where the Bee Sucks, There Suck I," from The Tempest, Act 5, Scene 1.
Nice emphasis on the suck, by the
Thank you.
way.
Thank you. I thought so.
But also, Shakespeare, being Shakespeare, also used musical instruments and playing techniques, to increase sexual innuendo and double entendre.
Oh, yeah.
So here's one of my personal favorites from Act Two, Scene Three of Cymbeline, when Cloten, one of our favorite characters, reports, "I am advised to give her music o' mornings. They say it will penetrate." And then
Ooh.
the musicians enter, and Cloten continues, "Come on, tune. If you can penetrate her with your fingering, so we'll try with tongue too." Yeah, that's Shakespeare. Like we said, if you think it's a dirty joke, it is.
That's right. That's right. And obviously, dances and music are mentioned all through Shakespeare, as Owen was just saying. Here's a couple of ones I've pulled out that I like a lot. Let's see. Ooh, do. So, for example, Stefano in The Tempest is singing, and he says, "This is a very scurvy tune to sing at a man's funeral. Well, here's my comfort." And then he drinks, and then he starts to sing again. There's a lot of that going on when people are drunk in Shakespeare, actually.
Yeah, there's a lot. That's true. There's a lot of drunken singing. But I just want to point out also that we actually have fewer extant Shakespeare songs like act that we know full on. We have the music, we have the lyrics, we have all of them. We only have like that we know were literally done the way they were done in Shakespeare's time.
That's right.
And once the theater started to go indoors, at like which it started to do towards the end of Shakespeare's career, but after that, we have much better records. Like, for instance, we have over 50 songs from the works of Beaumont and Fletcher when they were
That's right.
collaborating.
That's right.
And also, interestingly, not one single note of instrumental music from Shakespeare's plays has been preserved.
I know, isn't that awful? Because I think a lot of times he gave them a feeling or a mood that he wanted and they just improvised.
Well, listen, also, if it weren't for
Certainly
the
for all of the, the underscoring stuff.
folio, we wouldn't have half of his plays. I mean, again, we've talked about this elsewhere, but because the theaters were abolished for almost 20 years in 1642, we have lost literally hundreds and hundreds of plays. We talked about this in other episodes, I think specifically in Shakespeare Contemporaries, but
Yeah.
it's shocking how many plays we lost. And if it weren't for the folio, if it weren't for Shakespeare's friends putting that together, just about half of his plays would have been lost.
God, that isn't that amazing?
It's amazing. Yeah, you're sharing your sound.
Okay, so w as Owen was saying, we don't have a lot of things left, but we do have some songs that have been recorded, some Shakespeare songs that have been recorded by people. And we found a lovely website called shakesongs.com. And we would love to play you a little bit of some of these tunes. Like this one is Under the Greenwood Tree.
Under the greenwood tree, who loves to lie with me and turn his merry note unto the sweet bird's throat? Come hither, come hither, come hither, come hither, come hither, come hither. Here shall he see no enemy but winter and rough weather.
Now, I will say that every production that I've seen of As You Like It, that was basically the tune. Every
Well,
time
I
I.
mean, there are some standard, I mean, whether or not they all go back to Shakespeare's time or not, there are some that are traditional and commonly done.
That's right. That's
So
right.
we do have some of the songs. I think it's like somewhere between 12 and 15 that
Yeah.
we're sure
Yeah.
are the way they were performed in Shakespeare's time, but it's less than one might think considering how many songs there are.
That's right. Here's another one from As You Like It, a little clip of Blow, Blow, Thou Winter Wind.
Blow, blow, thou winter wind, thou art not so unkind. as man's ingratitude. Thy tooth is not so keen, because thou art not seen, although thy breath be
So that's a nice clip of that. Here's the Canakin Clink pub song, which is Iago's song.
And let me the Canakin Clink, and let me the Canakin Clink. A soldier's a man of life, but span why then let a soldier drink. And let me the Canakin Clink. And let me the canakin clink. A soldier's a man of life, but a span why then let a soldier drink. And let me the canakin clink.
You were saying?
That I hate to say it, but that just sounds like the bootleg ghetto version of Les Mis to me.
That's true.
Now, I have to, those last two songs, I have not, the first one was the melody,
yes,
that I'm
absolutely
familiar with. The last two, definitely
not so much. No.
No.
Oh my goodness. Well, I think we've gotten to the end of what we have today.
Yeah. Once we just had, like, you know, 14th Road Company Thénardier, I think we're.
What a terrible dialect, I have to say.
That's,
yeah. That was a terrible dialect.
We've inflicted enough pain on our listeners. We love you too much.
That's true. So that being said, please go visit our website at www.thebardcastyoudick.com. If you have any extra money, it's still hard these days, you can throw some money at two of our favorite podcast charities, Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS or the Actors Fund.
And if you'd like to support this podcast, of course, you can visit our Patreon page or our PayPal button.
And please, if you have something to say to us, send us an email at thebardcastyoudick@gmail.com.
We would love to hear from you. If you have any songs we missed or any dances that you'd like us to talk about, let us know, or anything we mistook, and we'll correct it.
That's right. And please do keep up with us on social media. As we said last time, we were on our friend Sean Hall's podcast, The Scuttlebutt, which dropped this week. And we will be recording another podcast as a guest for Modern Romance, which should be really fun.
Saucy.
remember,
it's Shakespeare. You dick.
The preceding podcast was a production of Country Matters, LLC, copyright 2022, all rights reserved.